about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Chip O'Brien, and he'll be answering your most important questions on California's best fly fishing. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Chip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up for our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of the show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Chip O'Brien about California's best fly fishing. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Chip, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight for our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Chip's section that says click here to register. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Chip's book, California's Best Fly Fishing, courtesy of Stackpole Books. If you want to find out more about what Stackpole has to offer, go to stackpolebooks.com. You'll find all kinds of great books on fly fishing. So we'll be giving that away now. Here's how you can win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and hopefully you'll win Chip's book, California's Best Fly Fishing. Tonight our guest is Chip O'Brien. In 1964, as a 10-year-old boy, he caught his first fish with his father's dusty old bamboo fly rod. More than a 3-pound largemouth bass got hooked that day. And Chip O'Brien has been fly fishing ever since and sharing his adventures, photographs, and quirky humor with others. Chip always wanted to be a fly fishing writer, photographer, and takes his avocation seriously. He has authored hundreds of articles in magazines, including Fly Fisherman, Northwest Fly Fishing, and California Fly Fisher, and his books are also available through Amazon.com. He also moonlights as an editor for Active NorCal magazine. While living in Northern California, Chip served as president of Shasta Fly Fishers 6 times and was named Fly Fisher of the Year and Doc Graves Fly Tire of the Year. He guided Northern California's best trout waters and taught fly fishing classes at the local junior college for over a decade. He is an FFF certified casting instructor. After moving to Oregon 7 years ago because of a woman, poor Chip, O'Brien now teaches high school English and digital photography. He also advises the Regis High School Fly Fishers, a devoted group of young anglers who sustain our fisheries in the future. Teaching allows him to take summers off, cherish time he spends exploring fly fishing venues all over the West, usually on his motorcycle. Beyond all these things, Chip also possesses an astonishing gift for attracting any whitefish, pike minnow, or nasty suckers within a 10-mile radius, allowing other anglers to have better access to trout. And he appreciates your thank you for that. Well, Chip, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and I'm sure you found a wonderful woman. Oh, I got you muted out there, Chip. Okay, you're on now, Chip. So,
all righty, yes. Roger, great to be with you and group, audience. Yes, I found a wonderful woman, and I'm a kept man. No complaints, though.
Well, at least she still lets you fish. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. I guess that was probably in the prenup, huh? So,
It would have had to be, for sure.
Yeah.
gosh.
Well, we've got lots of ground to cover tonight, that's for sure. And
we do.
You know, you wrote this book, California's Best Fly Fishing, and I've been waiting for a long time to kind of explore California because, of course, I'm out in Colorado, and we've done a lot of shows in Colorado and the Rockies here. But to have we've done a little exploration in California, but I thought, well, hey, this is a good place to start and get people familiar with California, what it has to offer. And your book covers a lot of ground, and after going through it and talking to you before the show, I think what we'll try to do is just cover Northern California tonight, and then we'll come back and do part two and do the Mid-Sacramento region and Eastern Sierra. And that way we can spend a little more time with each. And the other thing I want to promise everybody is here is Chip knows a lot of the guides on these rivers, and he's going to get me connected with some of the guys for specific rivers. So look for upcoming shows on all these waters over the next year or so. And we'll try to get some of these really good guides that really know these rivers and can really dig deep into them as we do with many of our shows. So that's the lay of the land here. So let's get going, Chip, before we lose any more time with my jabbering here. So why did you, and before the show you said, well, I could talk about a lot of places that are great to fish, but why did you choose the creeks, rivers, and lake you included in your book? Why were those selected?
Well, for the most part, I consider myself a devout wild trout guy. You know, as opposed to guys who prefer to fish for warm water species or even steelhead, though I do talk a little bit about steelhead in the book, but mostly I'm a wild trout guy. Now, there are a few destinations in the book, particularly in the Eastern Sierra, that do have the addition of some hatchery fish, you know, and in those cases, the place is just, those places have such grandeur in the Owens Valley and with the Sierra Nevada right there. So, the ones that I talk about in the Northern California area are really what I consider to be my favorite, and maybe I should define that, my favorite places to fish, you know, in the Shasta County, Trinity County areas. And there are just a whole bunch of them that I covered in the book. No two places are really ever the same. And, you know, I guess I'm like a lot of guys. You go to a place often enough, and you're just bound to fall in love with the place. And then writing, you know, leads you to really start looking at not just the fishing opportunities, but things like the entomology and, you know, the conservation of the area, but also the history and the people who have been there, you know, which just kind of opens up a big Pandora box of what I like to call, or at least my wife calls, useless information. So I know a lot of trivial things about an awful lot of places, but those places in Northern California captured my heart, principally for the wild trout and the scenery.
Yeah. Great, great. And it seems like a lot of the ones you picked there were in the, let's see, I'm trying to find it quickly in your book, but the Shasta Trinity National Forest area.
So that must be just a
great place to find wild trout water and play in the woods, it looks like. So.
Well, the backstory to that was I was down in Southern California. I actually had a career in corporate sales, and all I really wanted to do was fish. And Lonnie Waller did an article on Fall River in Fly Fisherman magazine. My buddy Val Atkinson illustrated it in black and white. Gorgeous, gorgeous pictures. And I was down in Southern California and read that and decided on the spot to quit my job and move to Northern California. And I did.
Yeah, and sounds like a good move, that's for sure. A little less crowded up there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Can be a little smoky.
Yeah. Well, it may be smoky in a lot of places in the West this year. So
that's right.
Let's hope not. Anyway, we had a couple of general questions, and some of these things I think we'll kind of address as we go through, because the plan is to go through each of these rivers or creeks and so forth, and kind of give everybody out there in the audience a feel for what that particular fishery is all about, and maybe pique your interest a little bit. But one of the questions was from Jim. He says, I know you have to be diplomatic about this, but could you include guides for the places you mentioned? So do you want to just address that real quickly, and then we'll, you know, as we go through the rivers, we can deal with it.
But. I could. You know, good question, Jim. It's a little difficult for me to answer, only because guides are a little bit like the weather. They change. And even since, it's been 4 or 5 years since I wrote that book, much has changed on the guide front. There are a couple of big guide shops that, you know, are always going to be a good bet. You know, the Fly Shop there in Reading is top-notch. You know, Confluence Outfitters, you know, let's see, Clearwater on the Pitt River. I guided for them for, I think, 14 seasons. There's some other folks up on the Upper Sac and in that general area. You know, it's almost hard to find. If you're going to a guide shop that employs, you know, kind of a stable of guides, they tend to be the ones that are going to laugh and really be there and tend to be the real experts.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I steer you toward those as opposed to just the individual guy who hangs out his shingle.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing, folks, if you are planning on hitting any of these places we talked about tonight, I'd suggest getting Chip's book. And he does list by river, you know, the shops in that area. So you could use that as a good place to start, make some phone calls, and get connected that way as well. So,
right.
So we'll kind of leave that as is, and because we'd be talking about a lot of guides here, too.
We could.
Craig Broyhill asked from Nebraska, he says, what are the fires doing to the California mountain fishing season, to fishing this season? Also, is the drought hurting the water levels, or are most of the water management agreements kicking in?
Craig, good question. You know, this probably is the worst fire season, and we're just getting into the worst fire season that California is likely to see, but it's certainly not the only one. Fires are nothing new to Northern California. In fact, you might notice when I did a lot of the photography for that book, you'll see, particularly in the Manzanita Lake section, you know, there should be big Lassen peaks standing there, you know, being stately behind the lake, but you can barely see it for, you know, what almost appears to be fog, but it's smoke. I mean, that summer, all of Northern California, there were hundreds of fires burning. So, you know, it's nothing new. Here's what I'd say about that. Yes, definitely less water this year, so you'd be able to access parts of streams earlier this year, right now, for instance, that typically would have been 6 feet underwater. It's just the way it is, particularly I'm thinking of the Upper Sac. But I don't know that it's going to be, you know, a whole lot different other than just lower rivers. I mean, the hatches are likely to remain about the same consistent. You know, it's kind of hard to say. The thing that always comes to my mind when I think of this is safety. You know, I've been out in those fisheries enough to have had a couple of close calls, particularly during the Fountain Fire in the early 1990s. I was guiding the Pitt River almost daily in those days. And, you know, the fire, you know, came to the very, very top of that canyon. I mean, we're looking up and it's on fire. And I remember I was one of the last cars they let out before they closed Highway 299 coming between, say, Redding and Burning, California on the way out to the Pitt. And then when they reopened the road, I was one of the first guys they let back in and, you know, got to witness the devastation. But I don't know. I know a lot of firefighters and, you know, you really can't take that kind of stuff seriously enough. You know, if you think you can outrun a fire or just jump in the creek, you have suicidal tendencies. So safety is the biggest concern.
Yeah.
Plus, I noticed they move really, really quickly. That particular summer when I was doing the photography for that book, I was on a motorcycle, and, you know, even then I had a hard time outrunning some of it.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and, you know, some of this you won't know until next year, too. You know, it depends
right.
on, like, you know, we had that one tragic fire here in Colorado that burned over, you know, the South Platte River area, and so it wasn't until the following year when you started getting all the runoff and all the soot in the river, and the, you know, then it really, you know, you saw the devastating effects it had to the fishery itself.
Right.
Some of that, you know, let's hope it doesn't get close to those rivers. But
well, there is one fishery I'd like to mention. I know we'll talk about the fishery specifically in a few minutes, but you know, fishing the Lower Sac in the Redding area, that water is really, really low. Typically, it should be running 14,000, 15,000 CFS this time of the year to fulfill water contracts downstream. But there's no water behind Shasta Dam, so they're having to keep the levels low. But the problem is there's still salmon in the river and salmon reds. And, you know, anglers go out there a lot of times, and they don't mean to be doing it, but they're wading right through the fertilized salmon reds and, you know, doing damage that you really can't see. But ultimately, you know, you're really harming the fishery. So I just would urge anybody who's going to be wading out in the Lower Sac this time of the year to watch for those reds, please.
Yeah, definitely. Well, just a brief mention of equipment, since you're talking mainly about trout here and not steelhead tonight, right? I mean, that's your
right.
focus. Okay,
right.
So what rig would you take around with you on your motorcycle to make sure you're all covered?
Well, the motorcycle adds a little aspect to it. I just, over the winter, I acquired on eBay an 8.5-foot, 3-weight Orvis rod that breaks down into 6 pieces. So it's ideal for taking on the bike. But I'm one of those weird guys that I prefer a softer rod, and I like 8.5 to 9-foot length on most of my rods. So where a lot of people are fishing 5 weights, I'm typically fishing a 3. They're more sensitive. It may take a few minutes longer to land a fish, which just, I guess, then translates into, you know, taking much better care of the fish once you do have it in the net and letting it fully recover before releasing it, and making, you know, darn sure the thing's ready to be released before you do. So I have an old 9-foot, 3-weight Scott G series that is my cherished favorite rod. That's my Hat Creek rod. That's when I want, you know, ultimate delicate presentations and want to protect 6 and 7X tippets. That's the rod I go to. And I would call that one my favorite. So okay. I usually have the 9-foot 3, and, you know, I've got a cheap Albright 9-foot 4-piece, 5-piece, 5-weight that I use pretty much for everything else.
Okay. Good to
so,
know.
Yeah, but the softer rod, and I say that because the fast rods are kind of all the rage these days. They don't do a very good job of protecting tippets, though.
Yeah. We had a couple of questions on flies, and one of them was, you know, what are your top flies for California streams? That's a really broad question, Chris, out in Brentwood. So we'll try to address some of Chip's favorites on the specific rivers, and then you'll know where they apply a little bit better. But Gary in San Ramon wrote in, and he says he's met you on the water, Chip, and you know, sees you rigged up with flies that have bright orange beads, and he wants to know what's your reason for using those flies, and are those flies geared more towards hatchery chowder waters? Now, is this a joke, or is this one of your...
No. This is... although you are forcing me to divulge a top-secret technique that I've used.
Okay.
So, Gary, this is what you were seeing, and I suppose it was probably on a section of Hat Creek around Castle. I've done it other places as well. But what I've done is I collect old fluorescent, usually fluorescent orange or pink fly lines, and I cut it up into like 1.5-inch long sections, remove the core, and then with my nippers, I clip off about 1/8-inch section. And with the core removed, you can string that little piece of fluorescent fly line onto your tippet. Typically, I'll put a wind nut or something in it to kind of hold it in place. And really what you're looking at is an underwater strike indicator. Let me explain to you what I mean. I use it for a technique called sight fishing. Especially works really well on that section of the Hat Creek in the little town of Castle. The water gets kind of deep, and some very, very large wild fish, both rainbows and browns, drift down from the private water up above. They do stock that water with hatchery fish as well. But typically, if you see a fish, you know, 20 or, you know, on up to about 26 inches laying on the bottom, it's one of those big brooding monsters. And I've learned that, you know, with enough patience and the assistance of that little bitty fluorescent spot that you can watch in the water, you can have a pretty good idea when your nymph is hitting that fish on the nose, and that's exactly what you want to do. The fish look like rocks. I mean, it's almost like they're stationary. They're attached to the bottom. And you have to, you know, toss your flies in upstream enough of the fish and with enough weight on it, meaning split shot, to get it right down onto the bottom by the time it hits the fish. And if you can do that successfully, you watch the fish, and if the fish so much as wiggles a fin, set the hook. You know, I know it sounds a little crazy, but I have landed some huge wild trout doing that very thing. You can't usually see the fly. Typically, the fly you're using is, you know, might be a 16 or 18, and you're fishing in 5 or 6 feet deep of water, you're not going to be able to see the fly. But that little piece of fluorescent fly line is different enough from all the things around it that you can really follow it. The light has to be right, of course. You can't really do it after the lights, the sun's off the water. But I've had some tremendous sight fishing opportunities using that little fluorescent. It's not a bead. It's just a little piece of fly line on my leader. Works great.
So is that, Chip, is that right in front of the eye of the fly?
Usually I put it up, you know, 6 or 10 inches.
Oh, okay, okay.
And when I get that little piece of, you know, kind of like watching the little fluorescent thing with one eye and the fish with another eye, I know that sounds strange, but, you know, they're close enough together that you can really see both. And when that little piece of fluorescent fly line is close to the nose of the fish, if that fish does anything, set the hook. And you would be amazed at how often that fly is right in the fish's mouth.
Yeah, cool.
It's really fun.
Yeah, good tip. Let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, let's talk about Hat Creek, because that's number one on our list, and we can talk a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkoff. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic reeling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Chip O'Brien about California's best fishing. If you'd like to ask Chip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show today. Well, Chip, now I was asked my guests at this point in the show what's going on in your fly fishing world, so what are you up to?
Well, I now reside in Oregon, and what I do to support my fishing is essentially I'm a high school English teacher, which means I'm very busy during the school year. But the magic of the job is I have summers off, which means I become a total fishing bum. What I really enjoy doing at this part of my life is obviously a lot of fly fishing, but I also tend to get there on a big motorcycle, and some are fly fishing, taking photographs, and eventually writing about it. Always wanted to be an outdoor writer. It's not the kind of thing that many people are able to entirely support themselves with, so teaching, although I love it, really just is there to support my fly fishing habit.
Don't tell the kids that, huh?
As they know.
Do they know? Well, good, good. Well, it sounds like you've created the perfect scenario for that. So.
Well, I'm a very lucky guy, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Well, let's talk about Hat Creek. Well, before that, Chuck Tadman and Santa Rosa want to know what your top streams were. And, well, Chuck, we're going to march through them here. We're going to talk about Northern California tonight, and Chip's going to talk about all his top streams. So you'll have to wait for each one. You're not going to get a list.
Kind of depends on the day anyway.
Yeah. So one of them in your book was Hat Creek. So tell us about Hat Creek, why it's special to you, attributes about that.
Let me first paint Hat Creek in broad strokes, and then I'll become more specific.
Okay.
You know, Hat Creek begins as a spring creek in Lassen Volcanic National Park, flows mainly north. The upper part, it's a tiny little stream, you know, hardly a brook. Along the way, springs contribute, particularly a place called Big Springs, and there is a section that is open to, there are a lot of campgrounds, public campgrounds in that section, and it, during the season at least, it's heavily stocked with hatchery fish. Then most of Hat Creek seeps back down underground as if it's going back where it came from. And then on Rising River, which the last I heard was owned by Clint Eastwood, just above Castle, Rising River contributes its flows, kind of bringing all the water back, and it flows through Castle, down through some penstocks and pipes into Balm Lake. And it's actually the section below Balm Lake, the 3 miles between Hatsu Powerhouse and Lake Britton, that is what most fly anglers think of as the real Hat Creek. It's only 3 miles of stream out of the 40, but, you know, it's sacred to fly fishers for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it's the toughest place to catch a wild trout that I'm aware of in the world.
That's a big statement.
Now, well, okay, and the obvious question is, why the hell would you go there?
Yeah.
And that is because sometimes, and I probably am strange, but sometimes I just have to test myself. Sometimes I have to just go and see if I can hook a fish. And you know what? Sometimes you do. And sometimes you get really lucky and have a phenomenal night, usually an evening of dry fly fishing. And it really is a tremendous place. But if you can come away with Hat Creek, knowing that you've been able to consistently land fish, wild trout on Hat Creek on a dry fly on the flat water, you've done something. So anyway, that's part of my attraction.
Yeah. So from what you've said, there's that section is a lot of flat water.
Well, yeah, it really is only one riff. Well, I say one riffle. There's a riffle at the top and a riffle at the bottom just before it goes into over the rough fish barrier into Balm Lake. But essentially most of it is, well, by all appearances, it's flat water. In reality, it's all the water is not moving at the same speed. You know, there are microcurrents everywhere. And you'll find that out as soon as you try to get a drag-free drift with a dry fly on that stream. It's very difficult.
Good luck, huh?
Yeah, but that's what's needed in order to get a fish, on the flat water at least. You know, most anglers start at Powerhouse 2 riffle, the riffle at the top of it, just below the powerhouse. And that's the easiest place to catch fish on Hat Creek. You know, a lot of guides take their clients there, and most of the daytime periods, you know, it's nymphing. And in the evening, everyone hopes to get one on a dry fly. And, you know, even for a novice in the riffle there, that's certainly a possibility. But it's down below that riffle where the water gets flat that it really, really gets sexy and excruciatingly difficult to catch a fish. And like
or
I said before,
Creek
that's why we do it, right?
Yeah. So,
and it is beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
So if you're, what would you consider some of the best hatches to try to catch there?
Well, you know, starting out early season, there's still blooming olives on the water, so you're talking, you know, 16s and 18s and sometimes even 20s. Let's see, there's a great Trico hatch. A lot of people like to pretend there's a, you know, a Terranarsis, a salmon fly hatch in the riffle. There used to be. I haven't seen a real salmon fly on the riffle since about 1992. But there are some goldens that'll be around in the air. And, you know, at least in the riffle, I wouldn't say so much on the flat water, but in the riffle you can get, you know, you can get fish to rise, particularly in the evening, to, you know, to big, unwieldy dry flies. Imitating salmon flies, but or golden stones. You know, later in the summer, the primary hatch of summer are the PMDs. There's some caddis sprinkled in between, mainly an evening phenomenon. But the big hatch of summer is the PMD hatch. Pale bony duns.
Yeah,
I'm sorry?
I noticed you kind of highlighted a lot of Bob Quigley's flies in your book. So are his patterns some of your favorites, I take it?
You know what? That guy was a genius. Bob is just, well, he's gone now, but we miss him. But his flies are like, you know, the standard, you know, for Spring Creek. Both his nymphs and his emergers, you know, his Hat Creek Spider, you know, is as effective now as when he first developed the thing. So, Bob Quigley understood Spring Creek.
And is it primary rainbows in here, or do you have cuts, or what's the...
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's probably 95% rainbows you know, I can tell you a little bit of the story of Hat Creek, if you don't mind.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, for many, many years, you wouldn't have known that bottom three section from any of the rest of the river in that it was just bombarded with hatchery fish for 50 years. And then some guys with Carbon Limited got together, and some other folks, PG&E, and in those days, California Department of Fish and Game, and they decided to try and experiment. They built a rough fish barrier at the bottom of it, so the pike minnows and suckers from Lake Britton could no longer get up into the stream. Then they rote-noned the three-mile section, killed every fish in it, only 2% of which were trout, by the way. Then they reintroduced native Hat Creek rainbow trout, and they also got brown trout from somewhere over in the Trinity River drainage, and stocked them back into Hat Creek, you know, half browns and half rainbows. Well, it turns out that the rainbows, of course, were native, took to the stream much better than the browns. There's still brown trout in there, but precious few. So I'd say 95% rainbows, Hat Creek rainbows, and the rest browns, and some very large customers. I remember this may be 10 years ago, but a guy caught a 17-pound brown on a streamer last couple of days of the season in November. He was rather elated.
Yeah, I suppose.
So I think he killed that fish, and he probably did the stream a favor by doing that. Can you imagine how many rainbow trout that thing ate pretty much every day?
Yeah, a fish so, that big, yeah, that's some people get criticized for those because they're trophy fish, you know, but fact of the matter is they're probably on their deathbed almost anyway. So.
Well, you know, there's another unique thing about Hat Creek and a few of the other fisheries in that drainage. There is a fish parasite native to Hat Creek called Ceratomyxa shasta. And, of course, the Hat Creek rainbow trout evolved with it, so they're completely immune to its effects. But what they found when they started stocking it with hatchery fish is the hatchery fish only lasted about 30 days and then succumbed to the effects of the parasite and died.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always like to think of that's God's way of keeping hatchery fish out of our sacred wild trout streams.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you know this off the top of your head, but it seems to me I remember that, and not hatchery fish so much, but wild trout, I think they only have like a, what, 6-7 year lifespan max, something like that?
Yeah, they're a little bit longer in lakes and, you know, a little bit shorter in streams. Different species can last a little bit longer. Cutthroat can live, and brown trout can live a little bit longer, I think. But what you said is correct.
Okay.
You know, 3 to 5 years, give or take.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Fall River, up in the same neck of the woods, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, may I make a little transition from Hat Creek
sure.
to Fall River? Well, I used to. I was lucky enough to be a part of a snorkel survey team. Twice a year, California would send us out to count fish. We wear wetsuits and. You know, have masks and goggles and flippers and the whole thing. We go underwater. We create a human line going down first Hat Creek. We did 2 sections of Hat Creek and then 2 more sections of Fall River. If you go to Hat Creek, there's a kiosk there in the, adjacent to the parking lot, and you see a line of, kind of, it looks like dots going across the stream. Well, those are the heads of people in snorkeling gear and wetsuits. I'm one of those guys. But we were... when I think of Fall River, you know, I will never get over the first time I snorkeled Fall River. I've never seen so many fish in my life. I mean, unfortunately, your angling successor, even on a good day, will not scratch the surface of what's underneath that water. It is trout paradise.
And why is that?
Well, it's a spring. You know, it comes out of the ground on Thousand Springs Ranch. Crystal clear, the water's in the 50s year-round, you know, deep, well-established, healthy aquatic vegetation. The hatches that existed over the course of the stream, you know, have been probably going on for tens of thousands of years. I mean, it's just a real dependable, easy place to be a healthy wild trout.
And, no,
you know, the private property along the banks, too, really protects it.
And it looks like it's all free-running river, no dams. That's the area for fishing.
as you get down toward the town of Fall River Mills, you'll start running into dams, and then eventually it flows into the pit.
But that's not where you're probably fishing, right? I mean, tell us
no,
about
the front. You're fishing, you know, maybe 10 miles, 12 miles upstream from there. Interestingly enough, I'm always big on names. The name Fall River, you know, comes from a waterfall that is now dewatered since they shunted the water through pipes to create, you know, hydroelectric power. But it's named for a waterfall that is now almost completely dry.
So
you're fishing upstream.
Yeah, from I noticed in your book you have Spring Creek Bridge, Caltrout Access.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sections we're talking about, or further upstream?
Right, that's Island Road Bridge, and you know, the trick with Fall River is to access. There are two public, well, actually one public launch on the lower river, the dredge site, and Caltrout is not public, but they, you know, it's private, but they allow anybody to launch a boat there. Beyond those two places, you have to know a landowner to gain access. But again, that isn't a bad thing. It really helps protect the fishery.
Okay, so the furthest upriver is the Caltrout access for a put-in for a boat. Is that
right,
other than knowing someone? Is that what you're saying?
Right, and it's entirely a boat fishery. There's no wading.
Oh, okay.
The river probably averages 10 feet deep. I mean, in some places, right off the bank. So you're not going to be waiting in fall.
I didn't really ask you that about Hat Creek.
Hat Creek.
Is that floatable?
It's only 3 miles. You know, I've seen people floating it. You know, and based on the conversation, you know, I overheard from my fellow anglers, they're happy they didn't get stones thrown at them. Not happy. I've only seen it floated once. But it's only 3 miles, but it's very wadeable.
Okay, so that's more of a wading
right.
river, and this is a
right.
fall is float. Okay, good.
Right.
And how long are the floats on the fall? What would you...
Well, it depends. Most of the guides, you know, that work it on a day-in, day-out basis, particularly this time of the year, they've got private access. You know, they usually have a lease with one of the landowners, and so they can kind of come and go as they want. You know, and based on where they have access, you know, they'll kind of make their own floats. What you tend to see is small gas motors and electric motors to get up and down the stream. So you can kind of, you know, it's not like in a drift boat where, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of the river as far as, you know, how long you float and so on. But when you've got a gas motor, you can go upstream, you can go downstream, you can fish near, you can fish far. You can pretty much go anywhere. So particularly in the upper river, guides and, you know, people who fish it a lot have certain areas where they know they're likely to be pods of fish. And, you know, fall's kind of interesting because, you know, the old axiom is, you know, in still water, the fish move around and the water stays in place. But in, you know, swift-moving rivers, the fish stay where they are and the water moves. But Hat Creek is kind of a hybrid. So you've got these sometimes very large pods of fish that will move upstream and downstream. And one of the techniques the guides like to use is they'll motor either upstream or downstream until they spot a big pod of fish in the clear water and then, you know, anchor for 15, 20 minutes, hoping the fish will go back where they were and then start fishing. But locating the fish every day is part of the Fall River experience. Unless they're rising, then you can see them.
Yeah. Now, I noticed in your selection of flies here, there's a lot of flies for the hex. So is that one of your favorite hatches on that river?
It is, and how could it not be? I mean, you know, it's got everything. It's got, you know, big fish, spectacular rises. I would like to say bugs you can see, but by the time the fish start rising, you know, you're really setting the hook based on splashes you hear. You're really not seeing them because it's so darn dark.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you're sitting out in this beautiful, tranquil river, and most evenings as the sun goes down, the sky turns orange and pink, and, you know, all you really see are silhouettes. But it's absolutely magical. You know, you can just close your eyes and listen to the fish slurping up hexes. You know, it's great fun.
Short
season. Can be very frustrating.
All right. It looks like hatch chart, what, end of June to July, first part of July?
I would say, you know, every year's a little bit different, but mid-June to mid-July is about it. Sometimes, you know, sooner and sometimes a little bit later.
Right. Okay.
And it's a great time to be out on fall.
Okay. Good, good. So these are all relatively within, what, an hour's drive of each other, these rivers we're talking about?
Well, Hat Creek and Fall River, you know, 20, 25 minutes maybe.
And now we're to McLeod, and that looks like it's in the same National Forest area, right?
Right. Now, it takes a little while longer to get to the McLeod, depending on where you're coming from. You know, a lot of it, you know, parallels Highway 89 in Northern California. And, you know, basically they're kind of two sections that are kind of regarded as the public sections. They're both below McLeod Reservoir. The first section is a couple of miles called Ash Camp. You have to drive from the little town of McLeod down toward McLeod Reservoir and keep on that road until you cross over the dam at the bottom. The river flows out, obviously, from beneath the dam. And then take a right, and the first little road that you see, it's not much of a road, it's a gravel thing, going down to stream level. And there's a small campground there called Ash Camp. And it's really the first access to that upper river because, you know, if you were to park on the road, you've got to scramble down a pretty steep hill to get to the water. And most of the hills along the McLeod are absolutely covered with poison oak. And if you're not allergic to poison oak, you should also note that underneath the poison oak are rattlesnakes.
Okay.
I am not kidding, Roger. I have seen more rattlesnakes on the McLeod. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but poison oak and rattlesnakes abound there.
Good to know.
I'm only halfway saying that to keep the you know, the really non-committed from going there.
Yeah, because what he's saying is he doesn't want you to go there because it's one of the best places to fish. But, of course, it has rattlesnakes and poison oak. Well, I just eliminated half the people that wanted to go there.
I know.
Yeah. Nice job. Okay.
Oh, gosh. The first
well,
time I fished
before you dig into further on that, let me take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll dig more into the McLeod.
Sounds good.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Chip O'Brien about California's best fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Chip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay. So, more about McLeod. Tell us about other than rattlesnakes and poison oak, what makes it special?
I'll get to the fishing in just a sec. I got to tell you, my first memory, the first time I ever went to the McLeod River, I remember a young couple, you know, a 20-something couple in shorts, were wading through the poison oak.
Oh, my God.
They asked me where to go fishing, and I said, do you know what you're wading in? The poison oak. He said, oh, my gosh, I'm really allergic to that. Where is it? He's in it.
Oh, my God.
I've often thought what their honeymoon was like. They were honeymooners. Anyway, so you've got about 6 miles or so of public water before you get to the majority of the McLeod is on private property between the McLeod River Fly Fishing Club and the Balabaca Club, which is all the way down above Shasta Lake where it eventually flows. But in that 6 miles, you know, I guess it's a little bit like Head Creek. I mean, this water is absolutely some of the best fly fishing water and just the most appealing, you know, freestone river water that you're likely to see in your life. It's got a subtle...
Chip, before you move on, I'm trying to figure out where you are on the map, and I've kind of lost you. Are we talking below the McLeod Dam or above the
cloud? Yes, just below.
Okay.
Just 6 miles just below.
That by Ash Camp there you were talking about. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Right. Okay, go ahead.
But one of the distinctive things about it, the water has kind of a bluish-green cast to it, which comes from one of the tributaries to the McLeod Ash Creek, which actually brings ash off the Mount Shasta volcano and gives the stream that distinctive color. But, I mean, there are days when the water almost looks iridescent blue. It's just a gorgeous place. You know, and a lot of the areas have old-growth timber. And it's, you know, it's a little six-mile stretch. You know, it's been logged a little, but not entirely like some places. So it's just got a certain amount of charm to it.
And I notice your map covers, you know, a much larger section above the McLeod Dam. So how does that
Yeah, finish? And that's primarily, well, there's the middle section just not terribly far above the reservoir is another campground section where they stock hatchery fish.
Okay.
And then above the top waterfall, Upper Falls, is reserved entirely for native red band trout, which are never large, but they sure are pretty.
Mm-hmm. Now, are any of these sections floatable? Are they all wade fishing? What's the?
They're all wade fishing.
Okay.
None of it really is floatable, you know.
Access,
although I guess I know guys who have floated down through the Balabaca Club, and I've heard rumors of, you know, shotguns and things like that. It's not something that's typically done, so it's a wading stream.
Mm-hmm. And what about public access? What's that?
Well, you've got that six-mile section, and that is the public access. What makes the McLeod a little bit different than, say, the Pit, which we haven't really gotten to yet, but, you know, it's got some deeper sections, the water's pretty clear there, so you can sort of see where the deep water is, but there's some big, deep pools, in fact, lots of them, in that six-mile section. And it's kind of the typical riffle-run-pool, you know, scenario there, so you can kind of pick out the kind of water you want to fish, because it all contains fish, mainly rainbows, although there's some gargantuan brown trout that live in there too.
Okay. And let's move on to the Pit. Now, the Pit is actually just downstream from Hat Creek, right?
Yeah, actually, you know, before any of the dams were built, you know, Hat Creek used to flow into the Pit.
Right.
But we're talking about the 20 or so miles below Lake Britton Dam. If you can see Lake Britton, which is just outside of the town of Burney, kind of below MacArthur Burney Falls State Park.
Okay. So tell us about the Pit.
Okay. Well, you know, there are kind of three sections or that people talk about, and they use the numbers. Most of the property is given over to dams and powerhouses and hydroelectric power generation by the landowner, PG&E. And PG&E has assigned numbers to the dams, like the Lake Britton Dam is dam number 3. So everyone calls that six-mile section between the dam and the powerhouse 6 miles downstream, they call it Pit 3. And everybody knows what they're talking about. Then there's another, you know, powerhouse and dam, and that's Pit 4, and on. So Pit 3, 4, and 5 are the sections most fished by fly anglers. So,
okay.
And it's a good long stream, and it's one of those things where it's not as deep a stream as McLeod, so it's wadeable. Since they've raised the flows, about 4 or 5 years ago in that river, if you could just find access, parts of it might actually be floatable. This is a project some of my friends have been trying to figure out where it put in. It'd be just sweet to fish the Pit River from a raft, but, you know, finding a place where you can actually put a raft in and take it back out again is tough.
Okay.
So I would call it, you know, for the most part, you know, a wade fishery, but it's also the most difficult wading of any stream I've ever. I mean, really, talk about, you know, greased bowling balls. You are standing on greased bowling balls, and you don't even think about going to the Pitt River without a wading staff. And even with a wading staff, you're probably going to swim eventually. So, you know, like the rattlesnakes, I guess that just, that kind of left out a bunch of guys, but, so
all the old guys. Yeah, all the old guys.
Why would you go there is the question. And, you know, it's a different kind, it's kind of the polar opposite of the Hat Creek experience. This is, you know, rough and tumble, physical, tough, primarily nymph fishing. You know, the bolder you are, the better wader you are, the more aggressive and or stupid you are, to go boldly go where no one's gone before, you're going to catch fish. You know, the river is absolutely full of rainbows. You know, in 20 years of fishing the Pitt, I have seen 2 brown trout. I guess there are a couple in there, but it's a rainbow trout fishery. But it's a fast flowing, hard to wade, glorious place to go nymph fishing. There are some hatches during the summertime where you can actually, especially in the evenings, hook fish on dry flies.
And it looks like in your fly section, several flies from Moorish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Kenny is just a master. You know, I love. You know, I've got certain, you know, fly tires that I just love. You mentioned Bob Quigley. You know, Kenny Moorish, Mike Mercer, who's with the Fly Shop, you know, Andy Burke over in Reno. Some of these guys have invented some of the best Northern California patterns, you know, ever conceived of. I'm leaving out Ted Fay and Joe Kimsey on the upper sack, but anyway.
And I noticed that most of the ones you included for the Pitt are nymphs. So,
well, you know, it's the quintessential nymph destination. I mean, if you want to learn how to be a nymph fisherman, you know, and a lot of guys, especially guys that I used to guide, you know, they just didn't get nymph fishing. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to a place to the Pitt River to learn how to be, you know, a deadly nymph fisherman. You know, the fish, the water is slightly off color, which makes it, the wading even more challenging. It's hard to know if you're stepping into 1 foot or 5 feet of water. You know, but the fish just don't rise on that stream like they do in a lot of other places that have more water that is more clear.
Yeah. Okay, so, anything more about the Pitt do you want to say before we move
on? Oh, Roger, I could talk all night. You better move me along.
Okay, let's move on to the up. And I know that's for a fact. All these rivers, you know, and creeks deserve their own show, I'm sure. So, but it'll wet everybody's whistle and get people thinking about it. So that's
good.
Upper Sacramento River.
Ah,
talk about
that's where
that.
I caught my first Northern California wild trout was on the Upper Sac, in the water adjacent to the Sims campground, on a dry fly. I'm proud to say.
Wow. You remember that, huh?
Yeah. It's one of those things. Yeah, you don't forget, you know. I just moved up from Southern California. I really, you know, I thought I knew how to fly fish, but I really didn't. Living in Northern California and, you know, becoming a guide and so forth really is how I learned. But, it was a glorious 16-inch, you know, wild rainbow. Even though they were planting hatchery fish in that section, this fish, you know, the fins were razor sharp and, you know, robust, lots of dots. I can tell a wild fish when I see one. Mm-hmm. And I got them on a dry fly during an Epeira's mayfly hatch, as I recall. So, anyway, one of the attractive things about the Upper Sac is how doggone beautiful it is. The water is really clear. The Upper Sac runs through a canyon, and you know, a lot of times you really don't suspect that you're right next to I-5. I mean, the freeway is just right there on the other side of those trees, and there's also a major railroad thoroughfare that goes through there. So, you know, the combination of, I mean, you may hear, you know, truck horns beeping every once in a while, but typically you can't hear the freeway from the river over the sound of the river itself. But sometimes a lazy train will go up the canyon and you kind of hear the echo of the train whistle, and it just really adds to the ambiance of the place. Plus, it's
and it looks like
out.
with Mount Shasta in the distance, part of the excuse.
Yeah, particularly below Sims, you can look right upstream, and it's almost like the pine trees on either side of the upper sack just sort of frame the view of Mount Shasta, and it's majestic, you know. Although I hardly think there's snow on it now. There used to be.
Yeah.
So it's a gorgeous place to be.
So it looks like kind of a freestone river there?
Well, it flows out beneath Siskiyou Dam, kind of north of Dunsmuir and west of Mount Shasta. So it's a, you know, technically, I guess it's a freestone stream. And, you know, it probably flows 26, it does flow 26 miles between there and Shasta Lake, where it flows, just like the McLeod and just like the Pitt. Tons of public access. Because it's adjacent to the freeway there, just about any place you get off, there are paths down to the water. You know, some are used almost every day of the fishing season, and, you know, others you have to hike to. And I highly recommend the ones you have to hike to, because these are wild fish, and you know, something about wild fish. You know, if you fish in an area that gets, you know, pummeled by every other guy that walks by, you know, the fish are just going to be that much more selective. But if you're willing to walk, and those railroad tracks adjacent to the river provide just, you know, an easy place to hike up or downstream, if you're willing to hike 10-15 minutes from where you parked your car, you're going to find some really superior fishing. So,
now,
you know, hiking is big on the upper sack.
Yeah, and that's usually the case, isn't it? If you're willing to hike a mile, you'll get away from a lot of the other fishermen. So,
I've always suspected that something about California fishermen, you know, they aren't secure unless they can look over their shoulder and still see their car. I don't know why people do that.
They're Californians.
I suppose so.
You know, that's the car people. Yeah. You don't want to leave that Maserati parked out in the open for too long. You know?
True, true.
Sun baked and, you know, all that. Ruined the
right.
paint job and all that. So, anyway, it looks like there was some kind of a Cantera incident. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, I remember that day in 1991. Yeah, I was working for Caltrout. I was a regional manager in those days when the tanker car went off the Cantera Bridge, dumping 19,000 gallons of an herbicide called metamsodium into the river. Metamsodium takes the oxygen out of the water, and, you know, even though they use gills to do it, fish breathe the oxygen underwater, and so do crayfish and, you know, salamanders and, you know, all manner of creatures. And so everything below there between the Cantera Bridge and Shasta Lake died. That was kind of an amazing day. I remember being on the phone all day long.
That's the whole section is what you're talking
well,
about.
I think, come think of it, there is 2 miles above there. So anyway, what they did was, you know, at least the way they brought the river back made a lot of sense. You know, there was a reaction, kind of a knee-jerk thing at first to, you know, restock the river. It had been stocked for 50 years, the majority of it, you know, to kind of get the economy going again. But guys like Caltrout and Trout Unlimited and FFF got in there, along with a lot of other folks, and prevailed to let them just leave the river alone, let the native trout come back. And fortunately, even though it happened in July, there was still enough fish in a lot of the tributaries that the river very quickly repopulated itself. Mm. I was also part of a crew. They captured a couple of fish from above the spill and spawned them in the Mount Shasta hatchery. I helped freeze brand those fish, and we put them back in the rivers in places that were kind of far away from tributaries to kind of jumpstart the fishery. But I remember the day that they opened up the river to fishing, 4 years later, which would have been, what, 1995, opening day of trout season, you know, other responsibilities only gave me about 45 minutes on the water, but I remember in 45 minutes landing 9 very nice rainbows. You know, it was almost too easy. So I was just amazed at how well nature can bounce back.
Now,
and today it's virtually fully recovered.
Okay. Is it, would you think of it as a mixed river of both nymphing and dries, or more of a nymphing river?
Yes, I would. You've got both opportunities. You've got, you know, it depends on the kind of water you want to fish. I mean, it's definitely got mayflies and caddisflies and stonefly hatches. You know, the big hatches on the river are, of course, you know, in the springtime, the golden stones. But in the fall, my favorite is the October caddis. You know, the upper, when I say upper, I mean upper sack. I mean, above about the town of Dunsmuir, I've never seen such prolific October caddis hatches just before dark. I mean, you don't want to breathe for inhaling one of those big bugs. And the fish go crazy. It's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed you also featured, was it Kenny Morish's patterns?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Kenny doesn't even live too far, maybe 2 hours north of there. But, yeah, his flies are just absolutely wonderful. And, you know, there's even kind of a suite of traditional flies, nymphs, that were created on the upper sack by guys by the name of Ted Fay. You should visit the Ted Fay Fly Shop in Dunsmuir, by the way, Bob Grace. At least used to be there. Anyway, they still carry that line of flies that was started by, the first guide on the river was a Winchu Indian man named Ted Cowandali. Then, and supposedly he taught Ted Fay how to fish the river. Ted Fay added a few flies of his own to the collection. He sold out to Joe Kinsey, who recently, four or five years ago, passed away. Joe added a couple of flies to the collection. So the upper sack has a suite of its own fly patterns, nymph patterns, weighted flies, all of them that were that evolved on that very river. So
yeah.
That's worth stopping by the fly shop just to look at the flies if not use them.
Sure. Okay, moving on. Lower Sac, Sacramento River here. Kingswick,
well,
Dam, Hampton River. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I got to put in a plug for one of my favorite places because it's right between Shasta Lake and what they call the Lower Sac. The Lower Sac is typically the section below Keswick Dam, which is in Redding. But above, between Keswick Dam and Shasta Dam is 9 miles of water called Keswick Reservoir. I've written about it extensively because it's probably my favorite place to fish because nobody ever fishes there. You know, you fish float tubes and a lot of big trout in there. I won't spend any more time on that. I just wanted to mention it.
That means everybody, that's the place you want to go, everybody.
I can tell you more about that if you want, but
okay.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot of rattlesnakes there too, though.
Anyway. Yeah, right.
The Lower Sac, depending on the season, and again, this year is different because of the drought. Typically, there's high water this time of year, and any time of the year, it's really best access in a drift boat, just because you can cover more water. But there are also tons of really easy wading accesses, you know, on both sides of the river for 25 miles downstream. Just get out any map and just drive along, and you'll find places to fish. So
it's
access,
like a pretty big river, right?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, this time of the year, I haven't checked what the flows are lately. You know, the typical pattern is summer season, which begins right about now, the flows usually go up to somewhere between, you know, 12 and 15,000 CFS, and then about mid-September, it drops back down to, 4,000 CFS, which is how it stays over the course of the winter. Fishing is open on the river year-round, and it does, in the wintertime, get salmon in, so you can fish for trout with, patterns that imitate salmon flies and that sort of thing, and do remarkably well. But so it's a year-round fishery. Like maybe the upper sac, you can fish both nymphs and dry flies, although I would say most of the fishing is nymph fishing. Obviously, when you see rising fish, well, you know what to do, right?
Right.
But, it is big water. The rod that I favor on that river is a 9.5 foot six weight, kind of a stiff old Scott Arc series. That seems to work really well. It's a little bit stiffer than most of the rods, but I can you know, chunk out 70 feet of line, no problem. You know, throw it upstream, you know, let it come down, put a couple of mens in and then feed line downstream. So I'm getting like over 100-foot drifts with an outfit like that. So covering the water on the upper, or lower stack, rather, is pretty important.
It looks like Caddis is one of the big hatches there throughout the
season. Yeah, you'll notice, you know, about in late February or March, driving over any of the bridges in the Redding area, you're going to have these green globs on your windshield. Do not turn on your windshield wipers. It's really gross. But those are egg sacs from the female hydropsychic caddis flies. There's they call it the blanket caddis hatch, you know, and I'm kind of interested to see, you know, what these drought years do to the river, because I remember the last big drought was back in the early 1990s. I have never seen caddis hatches on that scale. I mean, probably millions and millions of bugs, you know, hundreds of trout noses just slurping bugs. I mean, it's something that you never forget once you've seen it. So it is a big river, but lots of fish and lots of bugs. So it'll be interesting to see what the drought does to it.
Yeah. Okay, two more to go here.
Yeah, okay.
We got, we're doing good. Trinity River.
Trinity River. Steelhead. I would say probably the best. Yeah, steelhead stream in California. Certainly the most well-known. Certainly the most worked by a steady stream of really good guides for the most part. The two techniques that seem to prevail there, and it's most generally fished in a drift boat, although there are lots of places to wade, but it's one of those places like the lower sack. You know, the more water you can cover, the better you're likely to do. You know, it's not so much hooking a steelhead, it's finding a steelhead, and they move around. So, you know, it starts in the fall and goes through the winter. You know, you're either nymph fishing, and the Trinity River steelhead are kind of interesting. They haven't forgotten the fact that they started out as trout. I mean, you can catch, you know, Trinity River steelhead on, you know, PT nymphs and, you know, things that you would typically think of only really as being a trout fly. But they'll also take, you know, egg patterns, which a lot of people fish egg patterns very effectively. Or you can fish it with a spay rod or a switch rod and put anything out there that swings. I think I caught my first Trinity River steelhead on a purple woolly bugger, of all things, swinging it.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
And it's size-wise, it's kind of similar to the upper sack as far as size, so it's not a huge stream like the lower sack can be when there's water in it. A lot of access, too.
A lot of access. Now, what about other than steelhead? Is the trout fishing anything worth going for there, or is it primarily?
Well, people, you know, the fishing really kind of starts below Lewiston Dam, and there's a hatchery there, and they used to release steelhead smolts from there, and there are some big, very big brown trout that hang around in that section, and you can be surprised and hook one of these guys, you know, and really know you've got something. I mean, you'll think you had a steelhead, and you get this massive brown trout. So there's some big browns. It's kind of a hodgepodge because some of the browns are there year-round, and some of them also are sea-run. They'll migrate down to the ocean. But primarily, it's a steelhead fishery. I'm not sure I could tell, you know, a steelhead smolt from an adult steelhead. You know, it's really just a rainbow trout.
Right.
So that's really the primary fish. And particularly in that upper section, you know, from Lewiston on up to the hatchery, that's what you tend to catch.
Yeah.
I don't mean to make it sound like the browns are real common either. They're not real common, but they're in there.
Yeah. River to float, plenty of access, lots of good steelhead. I noticed you feature some of Kenny Morsch's flies here again. And also, I noticed in the past couple sections, fox.
You can fish what? I didn't hear you.
I noticed in that you had featured Fox's Sleech and also back.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Tim Fox's flies, absolutely. They're awesome. And, you know, those are flies you like to swing.
And then Tim, in the previous one, we were talking about the lower sac. You were talking about Fox's Poopah Olive.
Oh, that is absolutely a classic fly. Yeah, yeah. Tim's come up on some good ones for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of guys that fish the Trinity just love that crab, and that's, of course, the real attraction of spey and swing fishing and switch rod fishing is, you know, it's not even so much landing the fish, but it's getting that big crab on the tight line, which is pretty darn thrilling.
Yeah,
so the Trinity is probably the best place in California to do that.
Yeah. Do you think that's one of the most popular steelhead rivers in California? Or?
I think it's the most popular steelhead river in California.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, California used to possess many more, of course, but, you know, I think more attention has been given the Trinity and the restoration of that fishery and bringing back, you know, the native runs than any place else. And, you know, it's paid off.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Good to hear.
So.
Okay. We're down to the last one here. Good thing we decided to only do Northern California.
You're saying I talk too much, aren't
you? No, it's been very good, very good. I think you've been giving a great introduction to all these creeks and rivers. So now we're going to move on to the one lake you have in the book, Manzanita.
Mm. I love Manzanita. I thought I saw a question about that. Anyway.
Hold it. I did have a question. Yeah, there is one about that. But I did have, before we move on, about the Trinity, online here we did get a question from Walt Cole. And I don't know if this makes sense to you or not, or you can comment on it. But if you can't, just say so. But he says, why won't Cal Fish, because he used to work for Cal Fish, right?
Cal Trout, you mean? Cal Trout.
Oh, Cal Trout. Well, he says Cal Fish and Wildlife.
That's different. That's a state agency.
Yeah.
It used to be California Department of Fish and Game.
Yeah, so he says, why won't Cal Fish and Wildlife take brown trout from the Trinity? And he just said there weren't that many there, and put them in Grass Valley Reservoir to get rid of the trash fish. I don't know what he's talking about. Maybe you know.
Well, yeah, I do know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know that I can answer his question. You know, why does the state agency do or not do anything? That's a good question. It's part of the bureaucracy as far as I'm concerned. But Grass Valley Reservoir is a small reservoir on Grass Valley Creek, which is a tributary to the Trinity. And, you know, he's talking about trash fish. It's been a couple of years since I fished Grass Valley Reservoir. It's a 2-mile hike in with a float tube, but a tremendous place, at least it used to be. He's referring to trash fish in there, so I assume that some bad things have been happening there. Walt, I can't really comment on why they don't put brown trout in there. I imagine it probably has something to do with the fact that they would be afraid a brown trout or more brown trout would go over the dam and go into the Trinity River and eat steelhead and salmon smolts. That's my suspicion. Brown trout are very piscivorous. They like to eat other fish. So that's my guess, but it's only a guess.
Yeah.
So I would say, yeah, try to call the Region 1 wild trout biologist. I don't know who that is right now, but they're in Redding. And if they can't answer the question, I suspect they can give you the name of someone who can.
Yeah. Good answer. Okay, Manzanita Lake.
Well, you know, if you're going to create a perfect trout lake, I think it would be Manzanita. It sits at the base of Lassen Peak, a 10,000-plus-foot active volcano. It's been not quite 100 years since it erupted last, and it's why it's in Lassen Volcanic National Park. So you've got this kind of this mirror that is Manzanita Lake, and looking down on it is this huge volcano. So it's absolutely, you know, gorgeous. All wild fish. Rainbows and a few browns. The rainbows are native. Not sure where the browns came from, although, you know, before they got wizened to the benefits of wild trout, they used to stock Manzanita Lake many, many years ago. But anyway, it's all wild fish now. There is a stream, Manzanita Creek, where the rainbows spawn naturally. It's catch and release, fly fishing only, barbless hooks. So it's, you know, you don't see at least legal big plunkers there or anybody with stringers of fish, which is nice. Tremendous smorgasbord of aquatic insects there, regular hatches, nymph fishing, dry fly fishing, and it's wild trout fishing, which means it's never easy. You can also just puddle around in a float tube dragging a leech behind you and catch fish that way. But whatever you're fishing for at Manzanita, you know you're going to be in a beautiful place. And it doesn't seem like there are any small fish in the lake either.
Looks like from your pictures a lot of personal watercraft out there.
Yeah, yeah. Guys tend to fish it in pontoon boats and float tubes and prams. So it's a delightful. What's that?
No motorized.
No motors allowed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you know you're not going to get run over by a water skier.
Okay.
You know, some of the big hatches. You know, it starts off in the spring is mostly a midge fishery, then it kind of goes. The big summer hatch, of course, is the Calabatus mayfly, and the fish go for all the various phases from nymph to emerger to dun to spinner. And like persnickety wild trout everywhere, sometimes they focus on exclusively one phase of that bug and will eat nothing else. And so they're certainly capable of testing you. There's a big summer flying ant hatch. There's the capering sedge, the big mayfly that comes off on right at dark on summer evenings, and you just drag a big goddard caddis around, making a big wake like a water skier, and the trout, you know, nail it. You better have one X tippet on there, too, by the way. You know, so it's my favorite lake in California, for sure.
Good, good. Well, Chip, you did a great job. We've run out of time.
Thanks, Roger.
Just hang with me here. Folks, next time we have Chip on, we'll talk about mid-Sacramento region, American River, Yuba River, Truckee, and then the Eastern Sierra, East Walker, Upper Owens, and Hot Creek. So keep that in mind. Look for that show coming up. We haven't scheduled it yet, but Chip has agreed to return and cover the other half of his book. And in the meantime, if you can't wait, go get his book.
There you go.
All kinds of things. Well, hold on here, Chip. We've got a few more things to go through here at the end of the show. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and then we're going to give away a copy of your book, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and that's California's Best Fly Fishing by Chip O'Brien. So stick with us here a few more minutes. We're going to give away those prizes, and hopefully you'll be one of the winners. Mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project will be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine, and for more information on how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.com. That's www.inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and for our drawings tonight, it's too late to register, but next time make sure you do so you have a chance at winning one of these great prizes. And the first thing we're going to give away here is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that is a great organization to support and be part of. So if you haven't looked at them yet, go to fedflyfishers.org. Fedflyfishers.org is an international organization, and see what they're all about. They're doing a lot to help us as fly fishers and our fisheries. So Our winner for that is Gary Powell. Gary Powell in Tennessee. And so congratulations, Gary. And we'll be contacting you after the show to make sure that you get your prizes here. So congratulations. Our second thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership or subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. So that's Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And you can learn more about what Amato has to offer at AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. And our winner for that is Len Hoskin, and Len's in the UK. So congratulations, Len. Long way off, but fly tying is fly tying all over the world, right? So enjoy that that subscription. And then lastly, we're going to give away Chip O'Brien's book, California's Best Fly Fishing. Let me clear my queue here. And the I just realized we skipped a question, too. Maybe we can catch this right after this
okay,
for Larry,
sure.
Because he took so much time to write it. Well, let's just answer it now before we give away the book.
Okay.
Larry wrote in about Manzanita Lake.
Right.
And he recently read an article by you. Said the beach area used to be a great place to fish until several small streams suddenly appeared during early meltdown a few years ago. Says the ranger won't let him fish there anymore, and he hasn't been up there since. He doesn't have a flotation device. He says, his question is, has the area changed or is the beach still off limits? Do you know anything about what's happened and how that's changed?
Well, the short answer on that is no, I don't.
Okay.
But I do know the people who manage Manzanita Lake pretty well, and they're pretty savvy. If they say stay away, it's to protect the fishery. So I would stay away.
Okay.
You know,
that's
the area where Manzanita Creek comes in. So maybe it's an offshoot of Manzanita Creek. I don't know, but leave well enough alone.
Yeah, maybe fish are starting to spawn there or something with the creeks.
Yeah.
Or who knows? Yeah. Okay, so the question tonight is, if you wanted to fish a great hex hatch, what river would you go to? You wanted to fish a great hex hatch, what river would you go to? So
this is a question for me or someone else?
No. This is for our audience. I know you know.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. That's a test.
So you're if they get this right, Chip, then whoever gets it right, first one providing the right answer gets a copy of your book. So
perfect.
I am waiting for somebody to answer, and I've got an answer. He says the Fall River. Is Gary correct?
Ding, 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 ding. He's correct.
Yeah, there
yes.
you go. Okay. Gary, I don't have your last name here, but why don't you send it on over along with your Gary's in San Ramon. Send it on over with your mailing address so that we can get this book out to you. And I've got your email address here, but I do need a mailing address. So you can use the same text box. Just send the information over in that, and I'll get it. And we'll get you a book sent out from Stackpole. So enjoy that, and congratulations, and thanks for paying attention. So, Chip, hey, we really appreciate you being with us tonight, and it was just an absolute pleasure talking with you. You made it
my
very
pleasure,
interesting
Roger.
Conversation.
Hard to get me to stop talking about fishing.
Well, we're going to give you another chance, Chip. So.
Awesome. Wonderful.
So you can tell all the stories there that you didn't tell tonight. So,
and there are many.
There are many. Okay, good. Well, hopefully everybody on the show has found our archive. If you haven't found it yet, just look at the bottom of every page, look for archive, and you can go search. We're getting close to our 200th show here. I have to go look for it, but we're going to have a little celebration when we hit 200 here. But really close to that. So lots of shows out there, everything from trout to tarpon to different fisheries. Just go out and explore. Type in some keywords. See what you find. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the results. So have lots of fun with that. Our next broadcast is going to be on June 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Daniel Gallardo. And our topic for the show will be Tenkara's Evolution. Now, we had Daniel on the show a couple of years ago, and he's really the person that brought Tenkara fly fishing to North America and introduced a really new, exciting way to fly fish. So on this show, we're going to learn about the history and the fishing in Japan that inspired him to create his company based on Tenkara. And Daniel will also be talking about how he started his business and built a business into the success it is today. So that might be interesting to some of you entrepreneurs out there that are thinking about doing something in the fly fishing business. So come and join us for that. It should be fun. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think you'd benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673. That's 1-800-985-1673. And we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing.